Okay, let's unpack this deep dive.
Let's do it.
Today, we are immersing ourselves in one of the most powerful and really dramatic contrasts in human experience.
Right.
We're talking about the tension between absolute, just unadulterated bleakness, and on the other hand, enduring, world-changing hope.
It's a fascinating pairing.
It is, and our sources give us these two incredible parallel narratives that illustrate this perfectly.
The first is the life of the American missionary Charlotte Lottie Moon.
And the second is this really high-stakes, pivotal moment from the New Testament, John chapter 12, where Jesus is addressing his own impending death.
And what's so interesting is that in both cases, the source of ultimate hope comes directly from a situation that, I mean, by any human measure, looks completely dire.
Completely hopeless, yeah. And just to frame this for you, let's quickly define our terms. We're thinking of bleak not as, a feeling, but as an objective judgment of a situation.
It's negative, it's dire, it's lacking good, it's overwhelming.
Exactly. And hope is the other side of that. It's the judgment we make about how we respond to that circumstance.
It's the perspective we choose to adopt, what we look toward. We all have moments like that,
Yeah.
right? I think things that feel bleak.
Oh, daily, sometimes hourly.
Yeah, but holding on to hope is what transforms it.
Okay, so we have some really critical context for the biblical material from John 12.
Right.
This all takes place right as the Advent season begins, which means coming.
And even more importantly, the scene is set by the arrival of a group of Greeks.
Meaning non-Jewish people.
Exactly. And they are explicitly seeking Jesus. This is not a small detail, is it?
No, it's a seismic shift. I mean, historically, if you were a non-Jew and you wanted to follow the God of Israel, you had to convert. You had to become Jewish.
Right, you had to adhere to all the laws, everything.
But the fact that these Greeks are coming directly to Jesus, it signals that the old paradigm is, well, it's already collapsing. The invitation is about to become
All the
universal.
walls are already coming down.
Which frames everything Jesus is about to say. But before we get there, let's anchor this in a real human life. Let's talk about Lottie Moon.
Yeah, her story is just a stunning illustration of a hopeful legacy coming from a bleak end.
But who was she?
Lottie Moon, born Charlotte Moon, was an American woman from a wealthy, very established family in Virginia back in the 1800s. You'd expect her to live a life of, societal privilege.
And I found her background just remarkable. She was a real pioneer. She was among the first generation of women in the U.S. to not only go to college, but to actually earn a master's degree.
That is extraordinary ambition for the time.
It really is.
It is. But the source material notes she was also deeply hostile toward Christianity at first.
Really?
Yeah, her life took this profound detour in college when she, she committed her life completely to her faith. She abandoned that whole privileged trajectory to move to China as a single female missionary in the 1870s.
Can you just imagine that era? I mean, no easy travel, no cell phones, no modern infrastructure at all.
And she was there for nearly 40 years.
40 years. Wow.
Ministering through periods of just, I mean, global bleakness, civil wars, political turmoil, the eventual rise of communist rule, and just widespread, devastating famine.
And the challenges weren't just political, right? The people she was trying to reach, they would have distrusted her.
Of course, she was a foreigner, an educated woman. How do you even begin to breach that massive cultural gap, especially in a time of starvation?
Well, she found a way. She became known, kind of charmingly, as the cookie lady.
Little cookie lady.
Yeah, she used sweets and food as a way to attract crowds and build trust. This allowed her to build relationships and, establish a thriving ministry.
But what really stands out is her fierce advocacy for the people she served. She was relentless,
Yeah.
constantly writing these urgent, sometimes pleading letters back to American churches.
Begging for what? More people.
More workers, yes, but especially for more funding to address the starvation she saw every single day.
And this is where that contrast between bleakness and hope just becomes incredibly sharp. Lottie Moon saw this immense need, and she realized her own comfort was, well, it was a moral luxury she just couldn't afford.
She literally gave everything. I mean, she consistently diverted the money that was designated for her own support.
For her own food and
Up for
shelter.
food, her shelter, her clothing, all of it, to buy food for the people around her. It was a sustained, lifelong act of just radical, selfless sacrifice.
And that level of sacrifice, it eventually took an overwhelming physical toll.
Due to giving away all her resources, all her food, she became desperately frail and ill.
So, by 1918, she was so malnourished that the churches back home insisted she return to the U.S. for recovery.
She died on the journey back, weighing only 50 pounds. Her end was just profound. profoundly bleak, a direct physical result of her compassion.
You just can't imagine a more dire, sad outcome of pure selfless service.
But this is where the hope bursts forth.
Completely transforming the future.
That tragedy, that sacrifice, it fundamentally altered American Christianity. News of her death just galvanized churches. It led to the creation of the annual Christmas offering in her honor by Southern Baptist churches.
And today, something like 16,000 churches participate.
They do. And crucially, 100% of that funding goes directly to missionaries on the field.
That is the ultimate example. A hopeless, sad ending spawning this enduring, powerful legacy. Her death raised millions of dollars, funded thousands of missionaries.
It created a massive, ongoing, operational hope machine.
What a great way to put it.
And is a perfect bridge to the John 12 passage, where Jesus faces his own impending sacrifice, the cross, and insists that this moment of ultimate bleakness is actually the source of all hope.
Okay, so let's shift our focus now to John 12, verses 27-36. Jesus is looking squarely at the cross, and the source material pulls out three core truths that define the cross as the center of hope.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the first one. Jesus' death glorifies the Father.
This begins with that famous statement from Jesus, "Now is my soul troubled." And we often think that means he was terrified of the physical torture.
Right, of Roman execution, which would be terrifying enough.
Of course. But the sources, they paint a far more profound picture. His trouble was rooted in his absolute divine holiness.
So Jesus, who knew no sin, was facing the crushing weight of bearing the entirety of the world's sin.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was about to become what he despised, sin itself, and face the separation, the divine wrath that comes with it. His agony was spiritual, not just physical fear.
It's a crucial distinction.
It is. And in the face of this absolute spiritual crisis, he immediately frames the entire thing, not as a tragedy, but as a statement of purpose.
For this purpose, I have come to this hour.
And then he prays, "Father, glorify your name." He looks at the bleakest moment and asks it to be used to reveal God's character.
And the Father answers, audibly, from heaven,
"I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." I mean, what profound divine validation in a moment of utter human vulnerability.
So let's unpack that word glorify. It means to reveal or reflect God's character and identity, right?
Right. So when the Father says, "I have glorified it," he's referring to all the signs Jesus had performed up to that point. The miracles, the healings, raising Lazarus from the dead.
Those things revealed God's power and compassion.
Mm-hmm. But when the Father says, "I will glorify it again," he is pointing directly to the cross and the resurrection.
The ultimate revelation.
The complete and final one. The sources emphasize that the cross reveals two divine attributes that are, you know, otherwise impossible to reconcile at the same time.
Which are?
It reveals God's holiness, his complete separation from and opposition to sin. You see that in the judgment poured out.
Yeah.
But simultaneously, it reveals his boundless love and identity, which is demonstrated by the resurrection.
So the cross is where divine holiness and divine love perfectly intersect.
Yes, solving the problem of sin while revealing who God truly is.
That powerful revelation brings us right to our second theme. Jesus' death judges the world. Verse 31.
Now is the judgment of this world. This is a tough concept because we instinctively think of judgment as a future end time event.
Right, but Jesus uses the present tense. Now is the judgment.
The theological argument here is that a tangible, definitive judgment happened 2,000 years ago when the sins of believers were literally transferred and placed on Jesus. The condemnation was paid for then.
But if judgment already happened, why does the world still seem to be under so much influence from evil and, you know, despair?
Ah, that's where the very next line comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, will the ruler of this world be cast out?
Okay, so we know Satan is still active. What does being cast out actually mean in a practical sense?
The sources reference the New Testament scholar D.A. Carson, who offers two really powerful interpretations.
Okay.
The first is a courtroom analogy. Satan is the accuser, the prosecutor. But by paying the debt for sin, Jesus strips Satan of his legal standing. He's cast out of the courtroom because the case against the believer is closed.
That's incredibly liberating.
It is. And the second interpretation centers on control. Satan can no longer use sin, specifically the guilt and condemnation of it, to control and enslave Christians. Sin loses its mastery over them.
So that brings us to the relevance for you, the listener. If your sins have been paid for and the ruler of this world has lost his legal right to accuse you, what should that feel like?
It should translate into a life lived with, well, with freedom, with boldness and deep confidence. You're no longer entangled or burdened by guilt.
So if you feel stressed or anxiety rooted in failure,
the cross provides the anchor. Your condemnation is gone. You are free.
And that freedom leads us right to our final theme from this passage.
The universal invitation to all peoples.
Verse 32 is the key. When I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw all peoples to myself.
And remember that context we set up with the Greeks seeking Jesus. This is the final revolutionary confirmation of that.
By using peoples, Jesus is making it clear that the invitation extends beyond the ethnic boundaries of Judaism.
It's an invitation to Gentiles, to all nations. The salvation provided by the cross is globally available.
And that phrase, lifted up, it's intentionally ambiguous, isn't it?
It is. It points both to the physical cross and his subsequent exaltation. It's a powerful analogy that draws on the Old Testament.
The story of Moses in the wilderness.
Exactly. When people were bitten by poisonous snakes, they had to look at a bronze snake lifted up on a pole to be saved.
And here Jesus is saying, look to me, lifted up on the cross, and find salvation from the spiritual poison of sin.
But the crowd hearing this was just bewildered.
Right, because their expectation was that the Messiah would establish an eternal earthly kingdom and never die.
They couldn't reconcile lifted up, meaning death, with their prophecies.
And this is where Jesus pivots. He stops trying to reason with them and gives them this urgent warning in verse 35.
The light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you.
This is a moment of intense urgency. That word walk is a metaphor for your lifestyle, for intentional decision making.
He's urging them to live as if they truly believe God has established a standard, and the time to align their lives with that is limited.
And the ultimate condition, the new paradigm that overturns centuries of rule following, is in verse 36. Believe in the light that you may become sons of light.
For that audience, this was monumental. The required currency for salvation was no longer laborious adherence to rules and repeated animal sacrifices.
It was belief.
Faith.
It brings us back to that relief Jesus offered elsewhere, right? Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest.
Yes, the rest he offers is freedom from that endless cycle of trying to earn approval. Jesus took the ultimate burden.
So if we circle back to Lottie Moon, her life was filled with extreme hardship and, you know, what looked like personal loss.
She felt the urgency, the bleakness, but she lived from the hope of the cross, a hope that makes a purpose bigger than your own personal survival.
And that is the ultimate practical application. We mentioned earlier that our sources suggest stress often indicates we're operating outside our intended purpose, or in fear, not freedom.
So when you feel overwhelmed, when that bleakness starts creeping in, maybe you're overworked, financially stressed, the template for a response isn't panic.
It's adopting Jesus's focus from his own moment of profound trouble.
Father, glorify your name.
That refocus reminds you that your ultimate purpose isn't just to avoid pain, but to reflect God's character. And since your sins are forgiving,
and you are free from the ruler's entanglement,
you are free to live boldly for that purpose, even if the sacrifice involved looks, for a moment, bleak.
That realization should fundamentally change how you approach challenging decisions, which I think takes us to our final provocative thought for you to carry forward.
Jesus warned his listeners that the time to walk in the light, the time to make this critical alignment between your belief and your lifestyle, was finite.
He was speaking literally about his physical departure, but the principle, it applies universally.
We all operate under the assumption of endless time. We put off critical decisions. We postpone finding our purpose. We delay aligning our lives with what we know is true because tomorrow seems guaranteed.
But the narrative of Lottie Moon and the urgent warning of Jesus both emphasize that time is absolutely finite.
So what immediate specific choices does this realization provoke in your life today?